Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll cut through the noise with interviews, insight, and straight answers from people who make decisions. You will, I hope, leave knowing a little more than when you arrived. Coming up. A civil society group warns of an education power grab. Franchising could be South Africa's fastest economic recovery plan. Global investors pour money into AI health technology, and 100 global AI-era creative jobs are being offered in South Africa. It's Wednesday, the 10th of December. A civil society fight is escalating over how schools are run in South Africa. Free SA says the Department of Basic Education's proposed Bella regulations amount to, in its words, a power grab that strips parents, communities and school governing bodies of real authority. The organization is now warning that the rules would allow provincial heads of department to override admissions, redraw feeder zones and enforce capacity decisions with little transparency or consultation. So let's test some of those arguments. I'm in conversation now with the spokesperson for the organization, Ruben Kutzer, who says the regulations must be redrawn or rewritten to protect community voices. Ruben, a very warm welcome. Let's wade straight into this. Where's the evidence that these regulations will harm schools rather than improve access for learners?
Thank you, Jeremy, for having me this morning. So it's quite clear in the regulations that the proposed regulations by the government gives unilateral power to the provincial heads of department and really strips the school governing bodies of their authority. What we are arguing for is we are not saying that there should be less transparency and there should be no oversight from the provincial heads of government. We're just saying that we should have transparency and accountability while still empowering schools and communities and school governing bodies to weigh in on decisions that affect them directly instead of a one-size-fits-all approach. So you mentioned some of the aspects where there is a bit of a power grab. Let me quickly run through some of them. The first one is in Regulation 6 of these regulations, where it grants the head of departments the final authority to admit learners, including the power to override school placement decisions once a written notice is provided. This basically allows the heads of departments to, on their own accord, place learners without really consulting the schools. And furthermore, in Regulation 7, it allows the HOD to order SGBs to revise its admission policy within 90 days under the guise that it is inconsistent with the law. And this standard is quite vague because it really lacks that objective criteria and written reasons. And that's why we're really advocating for that there should be a balance between the community involvement and the government oversight.
So answer this then. Why should a head of department not intervene if a school refuses admission despite having the capacity?
That's exactly what we're saying. The policy should just be more clear. The guise under which the head of department can intervene leaves a lot of room for exploitation of power and really allows the head of department to use it as a political weapon. As we have seen in the past, that education is often used as an instrument for political parties to have their own influence. And that's really where we are coming from. We're not against transparency and oversight by head of departments. We're just saying that it shouldn't be at the cost of school governing bodies and communities, and that the criteria on which it is based on should be more clear.
Let's pick up Ruben on SGBs then. Why should school governing bodies not retain the final word when public schools are funded by the state?
We're not saying that they should retain the final word, but they should have an instrumental voice in the decisions that are being taken.
What does an instrumental voice mean?
Well, it is a voice that has a certain weight to it. I think it should be a balancing act. You can put it in percentages if you like, but there should be a balancing act between that. In this current proposed regulations, it really weighs stronger to the head of department And again, the issue that I mentioned is with the vagueness of the criteria. The decisions can be taken without any public consultation. It can be taken without any written reasons given. And there's also no requirements for mediation or arbitration, which from our perspective is something that's really important. And if you really value the beliefs and the inputs of school governing bodies, which usually consists of parents, community leaders, people who want the best for those who are in the school themselves and for the surrounding community, then their voices should matter as well. And the guise under which the head of the department wants to intervene should be clear and should be well worded, so that there really is not a room for using it as a as a political weapon and ensuring that balancing act.
Let me ask you this question then. Are you really protecting community voices or simply defending elite schools that don't want to take in more children?
No, we are absolutely protecting community voices. I think especially in impoverished communities, the voices of the community and parents is especially important because they know what's best for their kids. They know the needs of their specific community. One of the problems with these regulations as well is that it is a one-size-fits-all approach. It wants to put all schools together into one group and have one set of rules for all of them, while their needs might differ. And I think that's why we are hammering on the importance of community voices and parental voices, because community leaders and parents who have children in their schools across the country know best what the needs of their kids are in that specific school and know what the community as well has to offer in order to ensure that their kids can have the best possible education. And that's really what we're advocating for, is that it should be a balancing act. It shouldn't be a power grab from the head of the department, because we've seen in many other instances as well that the South African government is obsessed with centralizing power and more power instead of adhering to the democratically enshrined principle.
But is it really, Ruben, a balancing act? How do you answer parents who say the current system favors well-resourced schools and simply leaves poor children out?
Well, I think you also have to ask the question, why is there still an inequality with regards to schools in the country? Government has failed many of the schools in ensuring that we have equal access to resources, that there's equal access to textbooks. Our education, the National Treasury spends every year more and more on education, but we see now no improvements in the actual quality of education, especially in impoverished communities. Now you want to give more power, more unchecked power to the government, especially the provincial government, to ensure that this will take place. And I think when you look at the past record, it's just not going to take place. And that's why we're saying that balancing act is important, because we've seen, as I've mentioned, in impoverished communities, it's just as important.
But isn't centralization, Ruben, or a degree of centralization necessary to fix unequal admissions and also historic exclusion patterns?
Of course, it's important. As I mentioned, we're not against transparency and we're not against oversight. It's just ensuring that the regulations and the wording of the regulations, which aim to ensure oversight, is clear, so that there's no opportunity for it to be exploited, that there's written reasons given for the decisions taken, that there's justifications, that the data on which the decisions are being based is published, so that parents and the community and the country is aware of the reasoning for the decisions taken. And that's really what we are saying, is it shouldn't happen behind closed doors, but there should be clarity on why the decisions are taken. So we are definitely for transformation. Yeah.
And what do you say to critics who suggest that this is just fear-mongering and that you're exaggerating the threat?
Well, as I mentioned at the start, we are a constitutionalist organization. We are an advocacy group. So we encourage people who differ from the submission that we've made and from the views that we have to also give their inputs. Because at the end of the day, the submission that we've made to the Minister of Education, of Basic Education, is based on submissions that we have received as an organization. So people who differ from our views, we encourage them to read our submission. And where they differ from the submission that we have made based on the regulations, we encourage them to submit it as well, because we want to be a voice for the people and not someone who dictates our own views.
All right, Ruben Kutzer, thank you very much indeed. Speaks for the organization Free SA. I appreciate your time today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, franchising, as I understand it, contributes around 15% of South Africa's GDP and employs hundreds of thousands of people. Yet many economists still treat it as a side story. Now, the new chief executive officer of the Franchise Association of South Africa, Freddie Makhato, says franchising could be the fastest route to economic recovery, job creation and youth employment if the sector, he says, is scaled properly. The organization is gearing up for its 2026 conference with a bold agenda, bigger national impact, deeper skills transfer, and real financing solutions. So the question, I guess, is if franchising works, why are we not doing more of it? Freddie Makhato, a very warm welcome to the program. If franchising is such a powerful engine, then why do you think it is underutilized and for so long? Who or what is blocking the scale?
I think when you look at the current operating environment in South Africa, we are struggling, badly so, with job creation for the youth, one. Two, we are struggling to grow the economy because I think our economy is foreign focused, if I could put it that way. But we seem to be concentrating on the historical excellent sectors. But with changing times, we see those sectors actually dwindling. We see some investors exiting the country, investing somewhere else. We see skills flying out of the country. And we don't look around as to what is it that can work for us. We still pursue the traditional route. But when you look at the countries that we seem to be looking for solutions from, they have built their economies around franchising. So the question then becomes, why aren't we using franchising to build our own economy? Because if you look at other developed markets, the economy are almost 40% to 50% relied on franchising. Mm.
All right, so let's push your argument a little further then. What, in your opinion, is the greatest unrealized franchise potential? And why do you think that hasn't happened already?
I think the biggest issue is the focus on social upliftment through easy mechanisms. If you look at the focus now is to push education to the pass-mark rate of 30% so that you can have avalanche of children who are, in inverted commas, educated. But we leave the skills issue behind. So I think as much as we can do, as much as we are franchising, but if we don't have those kind of, that can actually invest in franchising or run franchise businesses, then we've got a problem. So the whole idea is that as the Franchise Association of South Africa, let's bring this to the fore, to everybody's eyes, that guys, there's this model. It's working. It has proven over the years. It has managed to build other countries' eco-economies. Why can't we do the same? So that is why we pushed to have engagement with the Department of Small Business, who are the custodians of SMMEs, to say, look, there are opportunities that we can bring that could open up opportunities for young people and women entrepreneurs.
Right.
And everybody and anybody who can invest in franchising and run a very sustainable business.
So, Freddie, which sectors within the franchising universe offer the most potential in that respect?
I think traditionally we know food. But we do now see health and beauty and wellness. We see education, and education is one of the biggest growing sectors because now I think that with technology, we are moving away from mortar bricks where you go to schools every day, where you can do online material and so forth. So I think with AI now coming at a stormy pace, so we will see changes even in other sectors as well, where consumers can access
You make a very compelling argument, but how do you ensure that franchising doesn't simply make the rich richer, but genuinely includes new entrants and those particularly without a large amount of capital?
That is why we have what we call the Franchise Manager Occupational Training Module, which is accredited with FACWAS now with a QOCTO, to say, anyone that wants to get into franchising and have got the appetite, you can do that module. That module will open more opportunities for those that are not in business for now. Then what we also have, we have an MOU with service data to say we need to upskill middle income earners to a level where they can also manage businesses. So skill development is one of the major issues. We cannot run a business without skill development. But what we are also saying is that you mustn't only look at owning a franchise business. There are opportunities in franchise like being part of the supply chain, being the manufacturers, doing all those things. So if we aim well, I think that we can make it.
But the problem still is entry into the sector, high club fees, royalties, equipment costs. Your challenge surely is always going to be to make franchising affordable for township and even rural entrepreneurs.
There are two streams. We have what we call the social franchising, which is one of the areas that is also growing. So social franchising, you look at those social issues that affect the society. You have somebody who's got the skills, who's got the energy, who can run a business from that point. So that is the low end. We also have what we call the micro-franchising. Micro-franchising are not those big brands or big businesses that you see. There are big brands that also are scaling down to create models that can be affordable to those that cannot have millions. You have now, if you look around, you can see some stores have scaled down to only provide for takeaway. In terms of the new models, you no longer have those bulk sit-ins, but also sit-ins as well. They also have small takeaway. Mm-hmm. Now we can see some stores diversifying. Right. Like yesterday, we went to a bookshop. Then you had a small restaurant there. So we see those kind of things. They will be affordable businesses out there that are coming up. I think we are at an era where we need to innovate. We cannot think back and cry about for foreign aid when we have the necessary tools that we can use to develop our economy. If we can move our contribution from 15% to 25%, I can assure you that will be a big achievement.
All right. Freddie Makgato, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Officer, the Franchise Association of South Africa. I do appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Billions of dollars are now flowing into artificial intelligence-driven healthcare, from drug discovery to diagnostics. And global investors are betting that AI will radically improve efficiency, speed, and patient outcomes. But South Africa, it would seem, is barely participating, as international capital chases. Health tech analysts are warning that we risk missing out on a major growth cycle unless local investors move quickly. Dr. Jimmy Muchachetere from Investec Investment Management joins me now to explain what's changing, where the money is going, and how South Africa can position itself to catch up in 2026. Jimmy, a very warm welcome. Maybe let's start with this. Where is AI currently delivering the clearest value in healthcare? Is it drug development, diagnostics, or maybe something else?
Right now, AI is delivering particularly in diagnostics and most of the administrative work. So healthcare is a heavily regulated industry, and there are a lot of T's that need to be crossed and a lot of I's that need to be dotted. And so it's a very administrative burden industry. And this is where AI is really making a difference right now. It's fast tracking the preparation of regulatory dossiers. It's helping to recruit patients. It's monitoring results. It's cleaning data and all those kind of things. But in terms of actual impact on patient health, diagnostics is where AI is making a difference, particularly in machine learning, where these systems can be trained to recognize what is normal and what is abnormal, and therefore they can run through scans and clinical trial results and blood test results and identify that which is not normal and flag that to the clinicians.
You're painting a very optimistic and bullish picture. If global capital then is pouring into health tech, why are investors in this country still hesitant?
Well, it's a number of reasons. I mean, biotech as a sector has been underperforming for the last several years. And there are a number of reasons why this is. The latest one has been political and regulatory uncertainty. When the Trump administration entered into office, you know, there was a lot of uncertainty about what was going to happen. And so, the, you know, this kind of kept investors away from the sector. But, you know, a few other things, interest rates have been high, which means that the cost of capital funding some of these early stage projects, many of which fail, is also higher. So that reduced interest in the sector. But many of these things are changing, and we're seeing a lot of deals happening. The sector is particularly cheap. A lot of capital is flowing in. The AI trade sucked a lot of air out of the healthcare sector. Some of that is coming back. And so, you know, we're coming from a position where many investors are underweight and are now looking to right-size that bet.
Are there specific South African subsectors that are best then or best placed then to benefit first?
Yes, vaccines is one that is particularly important. Healthcare technology is also another one. And by that, I mean, if you think about Discovery Health, for example, wellness, preventative medicine, personalized medicine, those are areas that are very well placed to benefit from AI in healthcare. And then on the generic side of things as well, there is not a lot of innovation there, but, you know, a lot of administrative heavy work, all that is also set to benefit. So companies that are there will see efficiency gains from increased margins as costs fall down because of AI.
But there is a concern over regulatory barriers and I would imagine policy gaps that could slow adoption locally, surely.
Yes, 100%. I mean, as I said before, this sector is heavily regulated. And so adoption of new processes and new technologies is always slow and has to go through regulatory processes. And so it will take time. However, this means that, you know, this remains one of the few industries where technology and AI could still have a massive impact. I mean, we're still early in the journey, but we're even earlier when it comes to healthcare and biotech. And the other thing that we're seeing is there is a long runway of opportunity to diversify for South African investors to access global innovation and therefore to benefit from the compounding effect of AI-enabled healthcare businesses.
So a long runway, but there is surely a degree of urgency, or do we, how narrow is that window to catch up in 2026, or do you think it's more of a long game?
I think it is more of a long game. I think 2025, we have seen the beginnings of increased interest in the sector. So, you know, we expect that 2026 will see that momentum increase. But, you know, it will take time because there are critical issues that need to be solved, bottlenecks, mainly on the regulatory side, adoption. I mean, AI is not perfect right now. And hallucinations are a no-no when it comes to healthcare. You know, when people's health are on the line, accuracy has to be 100%.
The other difficulty in all of this, I would imagine, is responsible investing. It's a big theme, and the challenge, of course, is to balance innovation with access and affordability to strike the right balance.
Yes, at Investec, we place a big emphasis on responsible investing. So we are always trying to see where can we invest, gain financial returns for our clients, but have the societal impact to boot as well. And that's what we are seeing. You know, healthcare is one of those sectors where it does make a direct societal impact. And so we are always trying to encourage companies when we meet with them and talk to them to say, how can you improve access to healthcare and to new technologies? But one of the things that we are seeing with AI is that it is leveling the playing field. So in addition to reducing the barriers to entry, it is also reducing the barriers to access, which remains a critical issue, particularly in South Africa and other emerging markets.
And just a final one, you talk about direct societal impact, all well and good, but can AI ultimately reduce healthcare costs for patients, or do you think, at least for the foreseeable future, it's going to remain a high-tech, high-margin space?
We think this is an interesting opportunity where it can deliver on both those fronts. So yes, it is a heavily regulated industry. Yes, governance matters, privacy matters. There are issues with biased data, but it is improving equitable access, and this is something that must be actively managed. We see many companies integrate ESG and responsible tech frameworks within their strategic initiatives, and also increasingly AI ethics is becoming a big topic. So on the one hand, you know, it is democratizing healthcare access, but on the other, it's also improving efficiency by reducing costs, improving margins, and therefore resulting in higher value creation for shareholders. So we think this is one of those unique situations where we do have a potential for a win-win.
Thank you very much indeed, Dr. Jimmy Muchachatere from Investec Investment Management. I appreciate your time today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, while parts of South Africa's creative industry are shrinking and worrying about artificial intelligence, I read that one global player is hiring and aggressively, assertively at that. BrandTech Plus is an international creative and technology network, and it's opened 100 new roles for South African talent, all serving global markets without the need to relocate. So let's dive into this with a little bit more detail. Candace Siege is with us, Global Chief Operations Officer at BrandTech Plus. Candace, a very warm welcome to you. The local industry for some time has been shedding jobs. What makes your company so confident about hiring right now?
Yeah, so I think, thank you, Jeremy, for having me. I think, you know, the industry at the moment is undergoing an immense amount of change. You know, we've got 100 plus jobs open for global talent opportunities, not just in South Africa, but obviously driving new talents and expertise around the needs that clients are starting to see in the AI and automation world. So we've got an incredible demand to deliver spectacular amount of expertise and talent for these clients' needs, driving content at scale, making sure that you know, they're delivering the best opportunities for their return on investment.
You describe South Africa as a global talent hub, and that really is nice to hear. But is there evidence or data that supports the view beyond just individual examples?
Yeah, I think South Africa is definitely in demand in terms of the talent aligned to UK markets and European markets, as well as the US markets. The talent that we have within South Africa is incredibly talented in terms of their drive, in terms of their expertise, high level of education and work ethic. We've got an immense amount of demand that requires this kind of talent. In terms of what the clients are requesting, in terms of their fast turnaround and adaptability is one of the things that they're looking for.
We all know that artificial intelligence, Candace, is changing creative work. The difficulty, I would imagine, is to balance new opportunities such as that with the risk of displacing existing roles. Is the industry finding that balance, do you think?
I think it's not really displacing roles, but really the change of roles and how we adapt to change. Change is inevitable in every industry, right? And I would say that, you know, those people that are interested in growing and developing their careers and ensuring that they stay ahead and want to win and making sure that they are doing their best work is really what's going to make them win. You know, adaptability and the ability for us to use technology to the best of our ability and delivering our clients' needs, that's what's going to put our best foot forward.
In terms of the 100 new jobs, is it just as much about the exchange rate as anything else? In other words, the momentum that you're seeing, is it about growing real opportunity for people or just offering international clients more cost-efficient access to skilled teams?
No, I think, like I said, you know, South Africa offers incredible talent that is time zone favorable for the European markets. We have an incredible talent base that gives incredible quality to those clients, aside from, you know, being able to show efficiencies at speed and offering scalable talent solutions is one of the biggest drivers for us. Obviously, you know, the expertise and capabilities and the self-starter mentality of the South African market, they're incredibly resilient and they are incredibly hardworking. So, you know, offering that flexibility and being able to do it from a remote first opportunity for the scale of the talent that we have is incredible for clients. And they're just, you know, South Africans are, like I said, resilient, and they're willing to do the hard yards and show what they're made of. I think a lot of, you know, our talent shows that.
Point is taken, but for an international client, yes, the exchange rate is also an added benefit. You have to concede that.
Of course. Of course. It's not the single driver, though.
Remote worker, Candice, often opens up global markets. I understand that it's not just happening in the creative industry, but is there not a danger that local teams are just confined to execution rather than being in the inner loop and involved in strategic decision making? And for someone that wants to progress up the ladder, that could mitigate against it, surely.
Yeah, so, I mean, we work incredibly hard at making sure that our talent is connected outside of just sitting behind a box. You can very quickly fall into the just get this done and get, you know, the assets out the door. But we've got a very, very robust process where we connect teams even though they are oceans apart. You know, our culture drives a lot of connection and the ability for us to create relationships with teams across the globe rather than just execution.
Are there lessons from your business model, specifically in the creative industry, Candice, that could be applied to other sectors? You must have a wealth of experience in this regard so far.
Oh, I think it absolutely is. Obviously, kind of physical production is involved in machinery, you know, it gets a little bit more difficult. But sharing knowledge across other industries and the ability for you to even in finance, HR, you know, a number of different sectors, you know, it's as good as an internet connection and being able to connect with the person on the other side of the Zoom or Teams call. Expertise is going to, and skills-driven expertise is going to be the differentiator. Those people that can be resilient and are able to operate across multiple different time zones and find connection between humans mostly. I think it's going to be a big driver for industries in the future.
And that is the way in which the world of work is changing. Candice Each, thank you very much indeed. Global Chief Operations Officer at Brand Tech Plus. I do appreciate your time. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.